Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with the one and only Peter Frampton, who's coming to the Kennedy Center on Sunday, October 16th at 8 p.m. Mr. Frampton, it's an honor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's very nice to be with you.
Now, have you ever done Kennedy Center before, or is this the first time for you?
No. Obviously, I'm looking forward to it because it's an honor to play there. So, obviously, we've heard it's a great theater there. Can't wait.
We can't wait either. So it's part of your raw acoustic tour. So is it going to be some of your old hits, but more stripped down, or what can we expect?
Well, basically, it goes like this. It's an evening with the Framptons. Basically, my son Julian Frampton opens up. He plays half an hour with his writing partner, and then I come on and do about, I don't know, half a dozen songs totally on my own. And then my writing partner, Gordon Kennedy, comes on with me for the rest of the evening so I can play some lead guitar. But it's just, at the most, two acoustics. So, it's very, very stripped down. It's a bit like Storytellers Meets Unplugged. It's a combination of the two, really. Just the stories about how the songs are written and what was going on, what guitars, what tunings. It's just a sort of an evening with me in the living room. That's the way that's why we're keeping the theaters intimate as possible. they seem to be getting bigger, though, each tour we do on these, but I like to keep it like a large living room so that we set the stage up like a living room anyway, and that the audience are sort of part of it.
Awesome. And you said your writing partner, Mr. Kennedy, it's perfect for the Kennedy Center. They named it after him.
Exactly. Kennedy at Kennedy, yeah.
Well, it'll be the Frampton Center after you're done with it.
Thank you very much.
So you said it's going to be stripped down and everything, but will you still have your signature talk box up there?
No.
No talk box.
That's all electric. So, no, it's just going to be acoustic. So you can come and see me do that in the with the band tours in the summer, but this is all acoustic. There's nothing electric at all.
That's really cool. Awesome. Well, take me back sort of to the very beginning. You were born in the UK. How did you fall in love with music? What sort of artist got you going in the beginning? Like, what were your influences?
Buddy Holly, which you can hear in the show because we do a couple of Buddy Holly songs.
Oh, nice.
The English Shadows, who backed up Cliff Richard. Those were my English influence, and Hank Marvin, the lead guitarist of that band, was the one that he had the first 1958 Stratocaster in England. So
awesome.
Everyone was all potential young up and coming guitarists were drooling every time he was on TV. So that was all instrumental, The Shadows, kind of like The Ventures were here in the 60s.
Yeah.
And so those were my influences, but the an underlying the influence that's been there my whole life has been from my parents, who during the Second World War, before and after, their favorites were the Hot Club de France, which is Django Reinhardt.
Nice.
And Stefan Grappelli. And Django Reinhardt, arguably one of the best guitar players ever to be on this planet. And so I hated that when I first heard it when I was like 7 years old. As my kids used to call it, Dad's listening to that silent movie music again.
Peter Chaplin.
So, I'm still studying him today, and up until I kick the bucket, I will still be cursing at Django Reinhardt for being that good, but such an inspiration. Oh, my God. A lifelong inspiration.
That's so cool. Is it true you and David Bowie went to the same high school?
Yes, we did.
Did you know him at the time, or were you just like acquaintances?
Oh, no. See, my father was the head of the art department, huge art department in this technical high school, and so Dave was in my dad's art class for 4 years, and so I knew of him before I went to the school. I was like 3 years younger, so when I did go to the school, I'd already seen him play around town in a couple of bands, one being the Conrads, and so I made a beeline for Dave as soon as, because my dad knew him, you know, and so I said, Dad, is there anyone at school that, you know, is into rock and roll, play guitar and stuff? And he said, well, yeah, Seth Jones is into it, I think. You bet, look him up. So I did, and we used to jam on the art block stairs during lunchtime. We would take our guitars to school, and my dad would hide them away in his office. So, yeah, I've known Dave since I was 12 years old. So, lifelong friend and a friend of the family. My father always had a great relationship with him because he was very creative, and my dad obviously loved Dave's creativity and all the guys that ended up in his art form for those 4 years, that syllabus that he would do. So when we did the announcement in London for the Glass Spider tour, and it was like a press conference, we played a couple of numbers. Dad and Mum came up, and after the show, I said, where's Dave? And where's Dad and Mum? And they'd all disappeared off together. So, yeah, it was like, it was a big shock when we lost him, obviously, because I knew nothing about that. He kept it very quiet, as he did with most things.
Yeah, well, thankfully we still have all of his music to be up
now. Oh, yes, we do.
That'll be alive forever.
Great memories of him and my dad and my you know. It's a warm feeling I get now after. Obviously, it was for the whole world. It was a huge shock. So
yeah, definitely. Speaking of playing those, you know, high school shows and everything, take me into the Little Ravens and the True Beats and the Preachers.
True Beats, yes.
And the Preachers.
The Little Ravens, the badge that my dad designed for the school. Get that was Ravens on it because it was in Ravenswood, the area Ravensbourne. And so, he put on an end-of-term concert. My dad put this thing together for the school, for the pupils, and then in the afternoon, and then in the evening for the parents. And it was kind of a variety show, shall we say. I got to play guitar in various different with various different acts, as well as my own Little Ravens, which was me on guitar, a friend of mine on piano, and then we had a bass player, but we had no drummer. But Dave and his band, George and the Dragons, because it was George Underwood who ended up doing the cover for, also in my dad's class, did the cover for Ziggy Stardust.
Oh,
and
cool.
Dave. So it was called George and the Dragons, and Dave and George sang, and so they had a drummer but no bass player. So we swapped, and they were the headliners, and we were the support. So,
nice.
Yeah, there you go.
That's so cool. Now, how did you end up getting hooked up with the Herd and then Humble Pie?
I was playing after the Little Ravens and the True Beats. Which was kind of Adventures Shadows sound-alike band. I then joined a band when I was 14, 13 or 14, called the Preachers, who were produced and managed by Bill Wyman.
Of the Stones?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Because the drummer of the Preachers was the original drummer of the Rolling Stones, Tony Chapman, before
wow.
Charlie. So you're getting a whole rock and roll history here.
I love it. I love it.
So anyway, I was still at school, but playing with this band semi-pro, basically, and we recorded a couple of singles and the beginning of an album. And it was during my stay with that band that during the school vacation, when it was time to either go back to school or drop out when I was 16, the Herd came to me and asked, would I join the band? So I had to ask my father, who's a teacher, can I drop out and join a rock and roll band at 16? Well, Mom had to do some severe calming down on that because I don't think my dad wanted me to join a rock and roll band. So, but in the end, he let me. So I got into the Herd, and within a year we were on Top of the Pops and making hit records. And that's how, when that sort of came to an end for me, I've just had enough of that band. It was too poppy. That's when I ran into Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane of the Small Faces and ended up jamming with them and recording with them and stuff. And that was when Steve left the Small Faces, I left the Herd, and we formed Humble Pie.
How do you think Humble Pie inspired what you would wind up doing on your own?
That was so many lessons rolled into one band there. First of all, being around talent like Steve Marriott, as well as the rest of the band, but he was a special character. There's not too many people that have that much talent in one person, you know?
Yeah.
And so I learned an incredible amount of stage presence, singing. Not that I have his voice or could ever sing like him. His approach to guitar, which was different to mine, but it was inspiring. So to be in that band was, I think, at that point is when I put, there you've got me playing a more lyrical, bluesy, jazz side, and Steve more heavy rock blues. So we put that together, and it became very fiery musically. And I think that's when I actually started to realize that I was creating my own style of guitar playing at that point.
Yeah.
And if it weren't for Humble Pie, I don't think that would have happened the way it did.
Right, yeah, yeah. All right, so now let's go on into your solo stuff. I think you had Ringo Starr in your first album, right?
Yes, Billy Preston.
Wow.
Ringo Starr, Klaus Voormann, all on a couple of tracks, yes.
How did those first, you know, let's say two or three, I guess it was like three albums, how do you think you sort of, those help, you know, pave the way and set up what you would do in your huge international breakthrough, Frampton Comes Alive? I want to get to that in a second, but those first few solo albums, were you still trying to, you know, were you sort of experimenting with who Peter Frampton is before your big breakthrough?
I don't think I was just doing what I do. You know, I didn't really think about it too much. I just, it was a case of going out there and doing what Humble Pie had done, which was record an album, go out and play on the bill in as bigger environment, an arena, open up for an arena act so that you grab some of their audience. That's what it's all about.
Right,
or
right.
Was then, was word of mouth physically. Now it's word of mouth on social network.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's what I did. It worked for Humble Pie, and I was come off the road after a tour, and I would write and record another album and then go back and tour again worldwide. It was actually four albums, Wind of Change, Frampton's Camel, Something's Happening, and then the Frampton album, which contained Baby, I Love You Way and Show Me the Way studio versions,
right.
Whereas Frampton's Camel had Do You Feel, so basically those four studio albums, plus Shine On from Humble Pie, that was about 6 years worth of material that I turned out to be, chose the best of to be the stage set at that time in 1975 when we went out and recorded what was to be Frampton Comes Alive.
That's so cool. Do you remember where you were when you wrote Baby, I Love Your Way?
Yes, and Show Me the Way. It was the same day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was in Nassau in the Bahamas. I borrowed Steve Merritt's cottage on the beach. I locked myself away there for 3 weeks. And after 2 weeks, I had nothing that I was very proud of. And so I had to get my act together for the last week, trying to write a whole album, you know. So I woke up that first day of the last week and said I better get my act together and picked up the guitar and wrote Show Me the Way in the morning. And then thought, well, this is the first thing that I feel is halfway decent. You know, this might make it. So I better, I had some lunch, had a swim, took in some sun, and I thought, well, let's try this again. I might be on a hot streak here. So I sat outside as the sun was setting and wrote, "Shadows grow so long before my eyes, and they're moving across the page." And that was Baby, I Love Your Way I wrote in the evening. So sunset. So, yeah, that's pretty much a good writing day.
So that's a good day in the life of Frampton.
Yes. Yes, it is.
That's so cool. How about, we'll only go into one more because we could go into a million of your songs, but what about Do You Feel Like We Do? Do you remember where you were when you wrote that one?
Yes, that was written when we were jamming the first incarnation of Frampton's Camel in the Old Kent Road in London, rehearsing. And I would bring my reel-to-reel and stick a couple of mics up and record the rehearsals because we jam, you know. And so we finished this jam, and the band said, "Wind it back about 3 minutes, because there was a lick that you played, Peter, that I think we might want to jam on some more." So we wound it back, and there it was. So the intro to Do You Feel. So then we just sat about that day, the four of us, just writing that whole arrangement. And I had a chorus that I'd written the night before, the actual Do You Feel Like We Do, Feel Like I Do part. And I wrote the verse while we were actually in the rehearsal room, I think. And I think I wrote the words down and said, "Well, these will do for now. I'll change them later." But of course, I never did. So it's the only song I've ever written about a hangover, and I guess it hit a nerve with a lot of people.
I love it. How did you come up with the idea to, instead of just saying "Do you feel"? How did you come up with the second "you"? The echo of the "Do you you"?
it's just the way the chords went. Do you? And then I could have sung a different word, but it seemed like a good idea. Repetition is good
in
songs.
That's fantastic. That's awesome. Oh, that's awesome. All right, so you've been compiling all these in your first four albums, and then what's the idea of all right, we're going to combine all this and go live with Frampton Comes Alive? I mean, were you had to be blown away at how huge this sucker became. I mean, this thing was put you on Rolling Stone magazine and everything. I mean, it went gangbusters. So, do you remember what's sort of the idea of let's package all this into the live set and you know, and sell that as an album?
Well, it all came from following the template that had been laid out by Humble Pie. Humble Pie had four studio records. And then we did a live album because the response live was greater than the record sales. Mm-hmm. So we thought we'd give them what they want. And it worked for Rockin' the Fillmore is still, you know, obviously a fantastic live album too. Mm-hmm. And that was our first the only gold album I had with Humble Pie, because I left before it came out. But so there we are. I'm four solo albums, and we looked, and the same thing was happening. The building of, you know, 4 years' work building around Europe and America, playing in front of as many people as possible in as short a space of time as you could. We were at the pitch. My act was at the pitch where I was in the middle act, and sometimes in smaller places I was actually starting the headline. So, and San Francisco, Detroit, and New York were kind of markets that were ahead of everywhere else in the country for me. And it just rooted well that we record in San Francisco. And that was the first time we headlined there, which was Winterland. So 8,000 seats. And you know, the rest is history. That was just one of those nights that you get where everyone comes off, the whole band comes off and says, wow, I had a really good night. That was one of my better nights. And everyone came off. It was the perfect night, you know. You get about a half a dozen of those on a tour. I mean, the rest are good. You know, even the worst show musically or performance-wise is always good, but we are so hypercritical of each band is, you know, right, of performance, that when you do get one of those nights, it's kind of special, and then you usually go, wow, I wish we'd recorded that. And we said, we did. So, you know, that was it. And we went to listen to it a week later down in Los Angeles, at Wally Hyder's studio. And that was the truck we used. And we were blown away by it. You know, it was the energy of it. And it really comes across.
Yeah, and those live versions are still played on the radio today. You can be flipping through and you'll still catch them. It's pretty incredible. Take me into the talk box. How did you start weaving that into your live shows? And, you know, more broadly, how does it feel to be associated with you know, an instrument? Like, not every person, not every artist is associated with something. But, like, when you think talk box, you're the first person I think of.
Yes, I have to always extend my arm and point to Joe Walsh, because Joe Walsh had a hit, Rocky Mountain Way, with the talk box on it before me, the year before, and we were touring together. I was supporting Joe, and I had a talk box, and I was using it on Do You Feel. That was the first time I used it. I introduced it on that at the end, probably around 74, and obviously Show Me the Way hadn't been written yet, so it wasn't on that one. So we would support Joe, and I would come out before him and use the talk box. And people loved it, obviously, but then Joe's big hit, Rocky Mountain Way, was the talk box, so there was a little bit of... I'm not sure how thrilled he was about that. Put it that way.
I would have
spoken over the years recently, and you know, he is the custodian. He was the first guy contemporary to use it, whereas, you know, the thing was invented in the 1940s, a very crude version of it, and then Pete Drake, the pedal steel player that I met on the All Things Must Pass sessions in London when we were doing George's album. And Pete Drake got out this talk box and plugged things into things and put a pipe in his mouth, and the pedal steel started singing to me. And that's when my jaw dropped. And that's when I said, where'd you get that? I need one. And he said, I made it myself. Well, that exact one that I went to America and found that Bob Heil was making them, but that exact one that I saw Pete Drake use, he lent to Joe Walsh.
Wow.
And that's the one that is actually on Rocky Mountain Way.
Wow.
So the talk box has an incestuous history. So, but it's something that is very simple, not expensive, but it's a very, very powerful communication tool Now everybody thinks it's a talk box, but it's auto-tune, you know. Yeah. But there's still something very, what's the word? It's very, very analog, the talk box, and it's very human sounding, whereas the vocoder and auto-tune is much more computer-like.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. We actually talked to Joe Walsh, what was it, I guess like last year. He was a great chat, but you're just as good, my friend. We really appreciate your time. You've been more than generous here. We're almost like on a half hour, so we really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's just in closing, you know, bring it back to the Kennedy Center. You know, how cool is it to be performing with, you know, family out there?
Well, that's great. We have the family bus, you know, me and my son and my friends, my best friends, basically, are on the bus. And so it's just an honor, and especially when Julian comes out. He comes out and does a couple of numbers with us, too, because he and I wrote a song that was on the Thank You, Mr. Churchill record a couple of years ago. And that was the song that he sang that we wrote was probably the most played song, you know, that the suggested track, as it were. And so I'm very proud of him.
Awesome. That's so cool. All right. In closing, why should our folks come out? If they're on the fence, even though they shouldn't be because it's Peter freaking Frampton, but why should they come out? What gets them out there?
Well, I think there's a side, you get a whole other side of, I think this is a concert where, you know, when I come out with the band, you know, you're sitting down and you sit back in your seat and you find, okay, this is the level they're going to play, and it's sort of in your face with the band, not overly loud, but it's in your face, you know, it's rock level. Whereas this is more like you're sitting at home on your couch and you put on something that's acoustic, and what happens is you sit forwards. And you want to really get into what's going on. And I think that's what the combination of the music and the storytelling does during this show, the Raw acoustic shows. It's something very different for me and for the audience. And I've had people come to both types of shows. You know, we've been watching you come out with the band for years and years and years, and we love the band, but this is something totally different, and we think we like it even better, you know. Yeah. I said, well, that's great, you know, that's then I've achieved my objective, that it's another side. It's a 180-degree switch.
Awesome. Mr. Frampton, thanks so much for joining us. It was awesome. And you're going to make a great storyteller at Kennedy Center, because listen to these stories you told today. It was awesome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.